health issues and that. And message this morning is taken from the Old Testament. Two passages, if you want to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6, and then we'll look at Deuteronomy chapter 11. I preached this message years ago at a rally. You know, we used to have those things. I don't seem to now, but I preached this message years ago at a rally, a similar message to what I'm going to preach today. And I think it is still pertinent and it's still apropos to today as it was when I preached it years ago at the rally. Because of the conditions of our society and our country and the world today. I would dare say, as far as the status of the Christian faith in the world today in society, it's not gotten better. But do we really think it's going to get better? I don't think so. And I entitled this message, and I would still say it's the same thing today, a haven in a heartless world. What should be that haven in a heartless world? It should be the family and the church and the family of God. Now, God is all part of that and should be. And we're going to get to that. How many of you ever read the book by Dr. James Dobson and Gary Bauer, Children at Risk? I have that book, and I know that we have the book in the church library as well. But they stated in that book that there's a, and they wrote this back in the 80s. They stated that there's a battle going on for the hearts and minds of our kids. This battle is not being fought with guns, but with ideas. What is at stake is our children and future generations. You think that battle is still going on with the hearts and the minds of our kids? I think even more so. Because of all the proliferation of social media and stuff we have. My goodness, my grandchildren already have their own tablets. You know, they already play games and stuff on them already. And they can do things on those tablets, you know, that just floor me. You know, and it's just amazing. Like when we visit the kids in Idaho, they'll sit down and they've got their tablets and going, well, not sure how to do this, and they'll say, well, Papa, let me show you, you know, and they're doing it, they're showing me. I'm going, wow. And my grandson's only 4 years old, the youngest one. He's already doing those things. So you see all the proliferation and how vast and fast things are getting as far as technology and stuff, and our children growing up imbibing all those things. But they're also imbibing some bad stuff. I read of, in fact, it was on the had a little short clip video of it, of this mother who said she was more concerned, now get this, she said she was more concerned about any violence and horror that her horrors, you know, bad things that specifically in violence that her children would see on the social media on their tablet or what have you, then she would be concerned about them seeing pornography. She'd be more, she's more concerned about that. She'd think, well, you know, the pornography's not a, that's not a big thing. I'm going, really? You know, you talk about addiction and kids. I mean, and her son, her oldest one, it's just in grade school, you know. And she's more concerned about him seeing violence and horror and things, bad things like that, on his tablet than pornography. That's not a, you know, he's got to learn about that, those things sooner or later, you know. So, see that battle? That battle is still going on. Beverly LeHaye said in her book, Dealing with Children and Growing Up, she said, we are building a society where children no longer feel, and we see this today. She said, where we children no longer feel the security and the value that the Lord has placed on them. That the American home has changed from the central haven of comfort, rest, and security to a bed and breakfast. In some ways, that's true. But did you know what the first passage is was taught to Jewish children? It's found in Deuteronomy 6. In Hasidic and Orthodox Jewish homes today, that's still taught. The first passage, Deuteronomy chapter 6. It is known as the Shema. The first thing that they're taught, there is only one God. Only one. That's the Shema. That's what they're taught. That the first passage that they're taught, they were to be taught, and what God said in Deuteronomy chapter 6. It begins with saying, now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you might do in the land where you are going over to possess it. So that, purpose clause, in order that, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandment, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you a land flowing with milk and honey. And here comes the Shema, what is known as the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. How many of you ever read any of the McGuffey readers? When we were deciding whether or not we were to homeschool our children or not, I picked up some of those McGuffey readers. And in one of the McGuffey readers, and I forget which one it is, but that the McGuffey readers are our parents and that. That's what they were raised on. That's what they had in school, the McGuffey readers. William McGuffey. And in within one of those readers, there's this poem. I first heard this from one of my favorite preachers, Wayne Smith, in Lexington, Kentucky. He read this, and I found this, and he found it first, and then I found it, but it's a poem about the home. Listen to this. Ah, there it stands, the same old house, and there that ancient tree, where first I trod in boyish pride and laughed in happy glee. But it is changed. The fence is gone, which girded it around, and here and there the fragments lie scattered on the ground. I love that old house with boyish love, for it did shelter me when I was but an infant upon my mother's knee. And oft I have looked upon the hallowed spot. Though I wandered far from it, I never did forget. And now it's changed, the door unhinged. The shutters, too, are gone. The pretty green that coated them is faded by the sun. The roof is old and crumbling in, fast yielding to decay. And those whom God hath welcomed there were called by him away. You remember me taught that as a young man, to recite that poem. A poem about the home, perhaps of where we have grown up. And we know for many of us that if we went back to the home that we grew up in, and I grew up in many homes, as my parents traveled throughout the state, from southern Illinois till my dad got a job at Chrysler in northern Illinois. So I grew up in different ones. But I can still remember some of those houses. And I would imagine if we went and saw some of those today, they wouldn't be the same, would they? Some of them, they wouldn't even be there. Some of them would be in decay, like this poem says. Those that are there. But think about that in relation to our lives. In relation to a ship, to a house, and what condition it is in. Christopher Lash, in his book, The Culture of Narcissism, stated this. And see if this doesn't relate to today, even. Now, he wrote this back in the 80s. But see if this doesn't relate to today. He said, as business, politics, and diplomacy grow more savage and warlike, men seek a haven in private life, in personal relations, above all in the family, the last refuge of love and decency. Domestic life, however, seems increasingly incapable of providing these comforts. And if that indeed, in fact, is the case, it is no wonder that Dr. Harold Voth of the Miniature Foundation stated this about the same time ago, back in the 80s. Our civilization is headed for collapse if we don't start caring more for our children and strengthening family life. Do you think that God knew what he was doing and knew what he was saying to the children of Israel when he said this? But when you look at the history of Israel, did they do that? You see, and I'll only get to probably this first point this morning, and I still firmly believe this today. The ongoing of faith. The ongoing of faith becomes the ongoing of the family. The ongoing of faith. The ongoing of the faith becomes the ongoing of the family. It's still the same today. As much as when I said this back in the 80s. We look at the condition of our world and our country. I firmly believe. Remember Jesus said that we're supposed to be the salt and the light of the world? I firmly believe this, brothers and sisters, that if it was not for the church, if it was not for those of us in the church, our world, our society, our country would be in total chaos. And that's what many of them want, you know, really, when it comes down to it. The Antifa movement. That just stands for anti-fascist. But you know the ironic thing is? It's those who are saying that they're anti-fascist and the Antifa movement, they're fascists. How contradictory can you get with that? But that's what they are. By the term of what fascism means. Because I maintain, you see, most of those people who say that this is fascist and that's fascist, they don't even understand what the term means. What's that, Tony?
It has to do with authoritarian control and imposition of a standard.
Exactly. And that's why... Right.
But, okay, so it's not the Nazi standard, but it's a different one. It's the same way.
But the anti-fascists are fascists in themselves because they want to be the authority, the answer, but said the authority and lay down what people have to believe and what they can say and what have you. Mm-hmm. If it was not for the church, though, if it was not for us, I firmly believe this, even though we are not a Christian nation, haven't been for years, I still believe that our country would soon be destroyed. But there's no getting around it. We live in a post-Christian world. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard of this, and they say that she apologized, although she apologized to Vice President Pence, but she did it privately, but what she said was publicly, and what she, Joy Behar of the, I don't know how you say that, Behar of The View, she said that, that Vice President Pence, because he believes in Christian faith, she said that he had a mental illness. Well, see, when she said that, was she just saying that about Pence? No, she's saying that about anyone who believes in Christian faith has mental illness. See, and many people in our country believe that.
The ironic thing is she might be right, because her idea of what she thinks the Christian faith is probably the twisted, worldly, corrupted one that is a mental illness. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean, but I also know that she's an atheist. And she makes no bones about it. But you see the mentality there? We live in a post-Christian mindset. And it's like what Rod Dreher says in his book, The Benedict Option. And I don't think that we need to necessarily do some of the things that he says, but I do think that he's got a point as far as we as Christians have got to begin to look at as far as the world is concerned. And that Jesus, well, of course, Jesus told us that it was going to be that way. That they hated me. They hate you. And many of us Christians, we have a hard time coming to grips with that. See? But Jesus said it. That's what the way it was going to be. They hated me. You believe in me? Expect to be hated. But you look at I firmly believe this, the ongoing of the faith. And you look at the children of Israel. God told them to do this. And he said, to teach it to them. Why? So that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, keep all the statutes and commandments which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. See that? God wasn't just telling them and set these things out just for them to do it because he was wanting to be mean and he wanted to destroy all their fun. He set these in part, in place, he said, so that your days may be prolonged. And you look at the history of Israel. What happened to Israel? What happened to the nation? Was there the ongoing of the faith? There wasn't, was it? They forgot about it. And as they forgot about it, and they forgot God, and they went into more and more into their idolatry, and forgetting God, what happened? You had the nation divided. Remember that? Solomon dies. Israel has conquered most of the promised land. After David, Solomon comes in the scene. There's peace. They're following him. Solomon gets old. Said he had over 700 wives and I forget how many concubines, almost up to 1,000 women. He said he loved foreign women. What does that mean? They weren't those who followed God, but idols. And Solomon listened to them. You think the rest of the nation didn't listen and adhere to idols? Sure they did. And so Solomon ends, dies, Rehoboam his son comes on the scene. That, they send Jeroboam, son of Nebat, to him to speak for the tribes. Your father did this. Kind of king are you going to, that's what they were asking. What kind of king are you going to be? And so Rehoboam goes first to the elders, doesn't he? To the older guys, Solomon's advisors, the older guys. And he asks them. And they said, well, you know, don't be more gentle. In essence, they were saying is be more gentler than your father. But then Rehoboam does what? Rehoboam goes to those who are his age. Of course, Rehoboam says first, give me 3 days, then you come back. So he listens to his father's counselors. But then he goes to his friends, those who are the same age. Hey, how should I answer these people? That's what he says. And what did they tell him? You tell them that my little finger is bigger than my father's loins. That's what he said. You tell him, my father did this, I'll whip you with scorpions. And that's what Rehoboam did, didn't he? That's how he answered him. Jeroboam comes and the rest of them come back 3 days to get this answer. And that's how Rehoboam answers him. And what did the rest of Israel say? They let Jeroboam be the spokesman, of course. So what Jeroboam say? To your tents, O Israel. What do we have to do with the house of David? That's what they said. And so the kingdom was divided, wasn't it? So Jeroboam, in order to keep peace and so that the people would not go back to Jerusalem, because that's where the temple and where the altar was, what did Jeroboam do? He set up in two places. In Samaria, in Israel, where they went in Samaria, and he set up in two places. One was in Dan, and one was in Bethel. And he set up what? He set up two calves. And he said, here's God. Here's your gods, Israel. This is where you worship. Why was he doing that? Because he did not want the people to return to Rehoboam. And so that's what they listened to. And so then you had, instead of the ongoing of the faith, you have the ongoing of idolatry, don't you? Yes. And so you have king upon king upon king, and what they do. But not the ongoing of the faith. But you know, when you look at that and you look at our situation today in the world and even in our own country, law used to be based, the civil law, it used to, you read some of Blackstone's commentary, for instance, and others during, by up to the Reformation and past that, civil law was based on Judeo-Christian ethics. It was based on God's word. In the Reformation, you had what was known as Lex Rex, the law of the king. But back then, what did the king go by? God's word. What is found in the Old Testament. Paul Robert, a 19th century great Swiss painter, he was known for painting huge murals, you know, these big paintings that you see. One of those paintings was on a stairwell of the old Supreme Court building in Lausanne, Switzerland. It was placed there so that the judges would never forget the basis of law. The title was this, Justice Instructing the Judges. And when you look at that big mural there that's going up the stairway, if you were to look at it, you would see several litigants in the foreground. A wife against a husband. A builder against the architect, and several others. The question is, what basis were judges able to judge those things? Well, in that same mural that you had that, wife against husband, builder against architect, and so forth, in that same thing mural, you had Lady Justice. Points with her sword to a book in that mural. And she's pointing with her sword to a book. You know what that book is? It's the Bible. It's the law of God. You see, they understood and knew that ultimately what stands behind law is someone. That's God. And it is ultimately related to the character and existence of God. Why? Because only God can provide something that's fixed. Only God can provide something that is absolute. But you know what today's law is? Today's law, when you go into court, you know, unless you're Muslim, not, if you're Muslim now, even like you're sworn in to be a congressman, one of our congressmen in Minnesota, Muslim, he asked to have, instead of a Bible, the Quran, which they did. when you go into court and that, the bailiff usually holds out a what? A Bible. And you swear to do what? Swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. And your hands on the Bible. But law, even though they even may even still do that, today's law is not that way. Today's law is sociological. And it's relative, not absolute. I like what Francis Schaeffer said when he said, the law does not stand behind God because the final thing is God. And it is God's character which is the law of the universe. Which comes down to this and what God is saying to the children of Israel. True guilt, true moral guilt, does not depend and has nothing to do with our finitude. Faith, what God was teaching the children of Israel and what's so important for us, because I firmly believe this, that the ongoing of the faith is the ongoing of the nation and the ongoing of the family. Faith, what God, you know what God is saying to us through this? That faith and the home lean heavily on each other. God was telling the children of Israel, you want your days prolonged? Then people pay attention to this. But if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 11, God lays out there for them, if you don't pay attention to this, here's the consequences. If they don't pay attention to it, are their days prolonged? No. Not at all. You see, I don't care what society says. Who put the family in place? God did. That's what Genesis 2:24 says. God put the family in place. Who designed the home? God did. Now, who put the church in place? Again, God did through his son. Jesus said, I. He didn't say the Jews, the religious leaders. He didn't say a continent, Africa, Greece, Rome, the Roman Empire. He didn't even say the good old USA will build my church. Jesus said, I will build my church. What was Jesus saying in that? I'm the one that's designed the church, guys. It's me. It's through me. You have the church through me. And nothing will be able to prevail against it. There is no known substitute. Contrary to what is taught today, there is no known substitute for the family. You look at the biblical mandate all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. The family has three purposes, which we have got to get back to. Primary was to continue the human race. Still that way today. Michael Novak, who was a nationally known sociologist, described the importance of the family for child raising. He says, why the family? First, without the family, there isn't any future. It is as simple as that. There's only one way for the human race to have a future, and that is for us to have children. If we should all stop having children, the human race would end when the last one of us dies. Now, some advocating that today, by the way. You know, they think nature should take over, you know, and we should die. They say, scientists say, that for a country, in order to reproduce itself, needs on average, I don't know how they come up with this, but says it needs on average 2.1 children per family. Did you know that there is not a single nation, not a single country in the world, in the Western world, I don't say Middle East or the Eastern, but in the Western world, did you know there's not a, that includes us. There's not a single nation in the world that maintains that today, that maintains a 2.0 children per family. Did you know that? Did you know the United States is below that? And they say that you cannot survive if you go below that. We've fallen below two. I forget what it is now. It's in something 1 point something or other. That in Germany and Denmark, the average has dropped to 1.3. And that, did you know that in some of those countries, that they're even trying to pay their women to have kids so they can up that? Guess which countries are having more, though? The Middle East countries, the Muslims. See, a lot of the Western nations in Europe and that, even in our own country, are not reproducing ourselves fast enough to maintain. But you know what is? The Muslims are, and they're immigrating to these countries. And they eventually, yeah, will take over because they're having more. And how you think they're raising their children? Aren't they raising them to be Muslims? And they continues on. See? If it weren't for immigration, populations all over the Western world would be decreasing. I believe, how have we gotten into to this state? I believe it is because many Christians have left this in the church building. They haven't taken it home. They haven't let it become part of them, to where they're teaching their children these things. The family still is. The family is breaking down at a faster rate than any time in history. And it's continuing to do so. And I don't blame that just on technology. You can't blame it just on technology. Why are our children being taught that when you go to school, especially now when you go to college and that, you need a safe space? Well, you know what the safe space is? A safe space is where you can go and you can talk with one another and that, what you believe. But don't let any other ideas Don't let any counter ideas come in. We don't want those. That's unsafe. Why we've come to the point where we have, if you will, censor? Because not wanting to hear those things. But it is directly a result of the breakdown. A breakdown of family. And it's been going on for years. We have a collapse of moral consensus. You know, we used to have a moral consensus in our country. But now we have a collapse of that moral consensus. Why? See, gotten away from this. They've lost the distinction between right and wrong. We have come back to the point as if the time of judging, where everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's why I say we don't live in a Christian nation. We live in a post-Christian society. Moral authority. Moral authority, what they want to teach, and what you end up with is you end up with chaos and you end up with crisis if moral authority is what you want to make it. What's that? But when God says, I'm the moral authority. I am. I'm the moral authority. I read years ago Herbert Schlossberg in his book, Idols for Destruction. He gave us a framework for understanding our place in history. And this is what he says, and I close with this. A society conscious of its place in history is seldom content merely to note changing circumstances with no attempt to evaluate their meaning. He makes a strong and valid case for the fact that idolatry and its associated concepts provide a better framework for us to understand our own society than do any of the alternatives. For he says it is a curious fact that the Old Testament, which describes the beginning, course, and end of a number of societies, never assesses them as being on the rise or decline or progressing or regressing or as growing to maturity or falling into obsolescence. He further says, spatial and biological analogies are incompatible with biblical thinking because they are both quantitatively oriented and deterministic of societies in place of those analogies. The biblical explanation of the end of society uses the concept of what? What people don't want to hear. You know what it uses the concept of? Read Deuteronomy 11. When you read Deuteronomy 6, you have to read Deuteronomy 11. What it is judgment. Judgment. Because they're not following God. It depicts them as either having submitted themselves to God or else having rebelled against him. And he says there are six idols: history, mammon, nature, power, and yes, religion. But whose religion is it? I maintain it's man's religion. I maintain that it's humanism. Did you know back in the 60s, Supreme Court said that humanism was a religion? But yet, that's the predominant thing that's taught in our schools. Why do I say that? Because what they're taught is that man is the measure of all things. When God says, you got that wrong. You are not the measure of all things. I am. But you see, brethren, what he says here. And we'll pick up with this again next week. Because the reason why we're in the condition that we are in, and they want it to be this way. It just boggles and blows my mind. They want the family to be removed from the center of life. When God says it is the center of life. In Deuteronomy 11, he lays out the rewards of obedience, and then he lays out the consequences if they disobey. That still pertains to us. So what do we do about that? Well, we'll take up with that next week. But what we should be, we stand and sing, what we should be is glad indeed. We are a part of the family of God. It's not something that we should deny.